The theme for the day is He Who Was So Kind. And what I do when I'm presented with a quote is I go and look up the source and preferably find it in Pali and translate it for myself. So the quote comes from the Mahaparinibbana Sutta, which you may have said already. It's in the Digha Nikaya, and it comes just after a time when Ananda and the Buddha have been discussing what to do after the Buddha dies, what to do with his remains. They discuss stupas and such things, and afterwards Ananda's upset, as you could imagine. And the text says in Pali, I'll just give you some Pali through the talk, just so you can hear what it sounds like. Atako ayasma anando viharam pavisitva kapisisam alambitva rodamano artasi ahancha vatami seko sakarniyo satu cha me parinabhanam bhavisati yo mama anukampako. And my translation: the elder Ananda went into his dwelling, leant on the doorpost, and stood weeping. The teacher who was so compassionate to me will pass away, and I have so much left to learn. So this word that is translated as kindness and I've translated as compassion is actually anukampa, and I'm not the first person to comment on this word. You may have come across it already. It's a lovely word. Kampa means to shake or to tremble. So an earthquake is kampana. And anu is a prefix which means to follow along or to go along with. So the word means to tremble with, to tremble along with. And it's the same kind of concept as the word empathy. So it's to feel what another person is feeling, to feel that same feeling in yourself. So in my talk, what I want to talk about is life. I'm going to go for the big background. Life and death and the afterlife. And then I want to talk about the Buddha's response to death, and particularly about his anukampa, his ability to empathize with other people. And to do that, I'm going to use a story from another sutta in the Digha Nikaya, the Tevijja Sutta. So, life. Scientists, people that study these things, think that the universe is about 13.7 billion years old. And a billion is such a big number, it's really hard to get your head around, isn't it? So I thought, well, how can I get that across? If you think of the number of seconds in a year, that's about 31.5 million seconds. So a billion is the number of seconds in 30 years. That's a big, long stretch of time. The Earth formed quite a lot later than the beginning, only 4.5 billion years ago. And the first evidence for life on the planet is about 3.5 billion years. That's the first definite evidence of life, is about 3.5 billion years ago. It's quite likely that life started quite a bit before that, but we don't have any physical evidence of it. And since that time, those 3.5 billion years, life has been continuous on this planet, as far as we know. It hasn't been easy for life on this planet. There have been times when the planet has been completely frozen over with glaciers right down to the equator, but still, although lots of species died out, life persisted. And there have been times when there's been massive volcanoes filling the air with sulfur and darkening the skies. And likewise, comet impacts, massive comet impacts. So 95% of all the species alive died out in those times. But life itself, life generally persisted. Life found ways to persist. And I think this is one of the things about life, is that it has this incredible, persistent quality to it. And not just life generally, but individuals that have life, or organisms that have life, are also incredibly persistent. In a way, it's one of these fundamental qualities of life that we recognise in other living beings, however small they be. Even the tiniest little bacteria seem to want to survive. I tried to find a non-anthropomorphic way of talking about this drive, this survival instinct, this urge to persist, but I couldn't actually find one, so I've just stuck with that. But, you know, I don't think we can attribute intention necessarily to a bacteria, but certainly they're persistent, aren't they? Yeah? So we, as living beings, we want to persist as well. We're very persistent. So the movie 127 Hours is showing at the moment, and having heard the story, I've decided I don't want to see the movie, but the story itself is fascinating. A man has his arm trapped by a boulder when he's out climbing. He realises that there's no one going to come and rescue him, and after a few days, presumably 127 hours, he cuts his own arm off in order to free himself, and he lives. And he writes a book, becomes famous, has a movie made about him. But it's almost impossible to imagine doing something that extreme in order to survive. And yet, people do all sorts of things to survive over history. You know, you think about all the terrible situations that people have found themselves in by design, or, you know, having them thrust upon them. So shipwrecks and you know, expeditions, climbing Mount Everest, going to the South Pole, and then on, you know, the more things that you don't will on yourself, like concentration camps and gulags and wars, and the sorts of things, the stories, the very inspiring stories often that people, things, the things people do to survive. They're some of the most inspiring stories that we tell. But there's something about some of us living beings, something that evolution has thrown up, which we call consciousness. And consciousness develops another angle, which is self-consciousness. So those of us that are here, we have this ability to reflect on our lives and to think about our lives. And one of the things that we become aware of when we do that is we become aware that we're going to die. So we're very persistent, but it can't stop this end point. And the story of that realization is dramatized in the Buddhist tradition by the story of the four sights, which was one of the first Buddhist stories that I heard, and partly what inspired me to become a Buddhist. So you probably all know the story. The Buddha sees for the first time old age, sickness and death, and it rocks his world. Nothing is ever the same after that, and he goes off in search of what's often called the deathless Amrita. So there's this collision between the irresistible force of life in us and the immovable object of the certain knowledge of our own death. And that's what I've called the abyss of death in the title of my talk, which I didn't say before. But it's our most fundamental motivating, driving factor, meeting something which negates it. And it's not just difficult, it's terrible. It's terrifying to consider. So more or less every culture, I didn't go out and research this very deeply, but every culture that I've ever heard of has some kind of belief in an afterlife. There aren't many people, perhaps modern Western materialists are amongst the only people that believe that death really is the end. It's so hard for us to take on, so hard for us to imagine, that it just doesn't seem likely, doesn't seem possible. So we have all these different cultures, these different human cultures, all, you know, sometimes very different from one another, but more or less all believing in some kind of afterlife. And we'll be familiar with usually at least two different types of afterlife belief. In one, after you die, you go to a destination. Yeah, so Christianity, you die, you go to heaven. The destination is usually conceived of in terms of the ideals of the particular culture which envisages it. So the different cultures envisage a different heaven which represents their values. I don't believe that any Christian actually expects to go to hell. Hell is just a motivating factor for getting people onto the path. They actually expect to go to heaven. So I'm not going to talk about hell. So that's one main kind of afterlife belief. There's variations on that end. Yeah. So the other main kind is a cycling one, a recycling one. And the simplest form is that you die and you're just immediately reborn. And in the simpler forms of these forms of afterlife belief, you're reborn amongst your own people. So you're reborn in your family or your clan, in familiar surroundings. You come back to the familiar. The Rig Veda has a variation on this where you die and you're reborn amongst the fathers, they're called, the Pitra, and then you come back to your family. I should say also that all these belief systems that I'm aware of are all very masculine. Heaven seem to be envisaged by men, and often only for men, as in the Rig Veda is really only for men. I don't know what women do in that culture. So cycling round with some variations. But at some point, rebirth beliefs are actually quite widespread. There's American Indian peoples with rebirth beliefs. There's the ancient Greeks had a rebirth belief. Of course, India. There's Pacific Island cultures have rebirth beliefs. So they're actually quite widespread, quite as widespread as destination rebirth beliefs. But in India, something a little bit different happened. The rebirth, the coming again and again, came to be seen as a burden about something that you didn't want to keep happening. And so we'll meet some of these people in Taivija Sutta. They see continual rebirth as a burden, and what they seek is release from it. So this is a kind of hybrid belief where you go round and round if you do nothing, but you can spin off and go somewhere if you intervene. And for Brahmins in the Buddhist day, this was merging with Brahma, Brahma Sahavyata. And Buddhists also have this belief that we go round and round, but if we intervene in the right way, we spin off and we don't say anything too much about what happens after that. Nirvana is ineffable, but it's better than going round and round at the very least. And Buddhist rebirth beliefs are actually the most complex, the most involved beliefs, and so there's lots of destinations depending on what you do. And in this life, you can go to any of six realms. The heaven realms are divided into 33 layers. The hell realms have got lots of layers as well. Buddhists also added some extra features to this. We have the idea of the Pure Land, which is a kind of intermediate heaven where you go, and again, it's an idealized place where everything that you need is there for you, and you, of course, are guaranteed to become enlightened there, which is our highest value. And the Tibetans added the idea of the bardo. So after you die, there's a period of up to 7 weeks, 49 days I think it is, where you go through a series of decisions, a series of crisis points where you can branch off one way or the other. So now I've come to the Buddha and his response, and the story that I'm going to use to talk about is from the Tevijja Sutta. It's in the Digha Nikaya, number 13. And in this text, there are two young Brahmin men, and they're in a town with lots of famous teachers. They each have a different teacher, and their two teachers teach different ways to merging with Brahma. And they have a religious debate, and they can't decide. They can't convince each other of their views. So they decide they're going to go and see the Buddha, and they'll agree with whatever he says in the end. Seems an unlikely thing for a Brahmin to do, but that's what they do. It's a Buddhist story, so. So their goal, their religious goal, is Brahma Sahavyata, which Sahavyata means companionship. But the idea is that you merge into Brahma, like a water drop merging back into the ocean. So you lose your personal identity and you become part of this great cosmic Brahman, which only has three characteristics: Sat Chit Ananda, being, consciousness, and bliss. So the Buddha does what he often does. He starts asking them questions. He says to them, "Well, if we're talking about the way leading to Brahma, do you know Brahma? Have you met Brahma face to face?" And they say, no. And he says, well, do you know Brahma's realm? You know, you've got an opinion about this, so is this from personal experience? And they say, no. And they don't know the way to Brahma's realm either. And Buddha says, so what about your teachers then? Do they know Brahma personally? And these chaps have to admit, no, they don't. And they don't know Brahma's realm, and they don't know the way to get there. And so the Buddha says, well, you know, they're part of a lineage of teachers, so, you know, is there someone along the line who knows Brahma and Brahma's realm and how to get there? And they say, no. You think this is funny, but you read the sutta and change the word Brahma for Nirvana or Buddha, and it's very interesting. It is funny. And actually, the sutta is a parody. It's one of the few suttas where there are jokes, if you know what you're looking for. So the Buddha then says to these guys, he's ascertained that they don't know what they're talking about. There's just these traditions that they spout that they don't actually know. That's why they can't decide. That's why they can't convince each other, because it's just their opinions. And of course, when there's a clash of two opinions, unless someone wants to be convinced, they won't be. Because usually if you've formed an opinion, you already think that that's the best opinion. So he says this thing to them, which is a funny thing to say. I've been really struck by this as I've thought over the material and gone over my talk. He says to them, I'll give you the Pali again. He says to them, Brahmanam chaham pajanami brahmalokancha brahmaloka gamanincha patipadam. I know Brahma and Brahma's realm and the way leading to Brahma's realm. So we've got the Buddha saying, and if I translate this into contemporary idiom, the Buddha is saying, well, I know God and I know heaven and I know the way to get to heaven. Which is a really interesting thing for the Buddha to say, I think. And I still haven't gotten over it, really. But fortunately, we get a bit more back on track, a bit more obviously Buddhist, and because they're intrigued by this, of course. They went to see him thinking that they would go along with whatever he said. So they say, well, teach us, tell us what the answer is. And he teaches them something that you'll all be familiar with. He teaches them a variation on some meditations which we teach here and in all our centres. He teaches them metta bhavana, karuna bhavana, mudita bhavana and upekkha bhavana, what we call the Brahma Vihara meditations. Now, better scholars than me have suggested that this is the context where the name Brahma Vihara gets invented, because Brahma Vihara means dwelling with God, and it plays on the goal of the Brahmins to be reborn in Brahma or with Brahma, and it's virtually a synonym of Brahma Sahavyata. It doesn't mean that it's a Hindu teaching, or that he's drawing on Hindu or Brahminical ideas. He's just using it as a tag so they can understand. I'll come back to that. So he teaches them to dwell in metta, radiating metta and karuna, etc., radiating it out to the world. And he teaches them this more or less saying, well, look, if your goal is what you say it is, then this is how you achieve it, and you don't have to wait until after you're dead. In the Karaniya Metta Sutta, we get another take on this meditations. In the second to last verse, Titang charang nisino va sayanova yavatassa vigata midho etam satim aditeya brahmam metam viharam idam ahu. Whatever you are doing in every activity, as far as is humanly possible, sustain these reflections, these practices. To do so, it is said, is to dwell with God right here and now. So I just want to finish up with some observations about this approach that the Buddha's taken. So the first thing that struck me is I've read a few Richard Dawkins books recently, and Richard Dawkins is, describes himself as a militant atheist, and he seems to particularly want to tell people that superstitious views are stupid. He doesn't quite say stupid, but he's very pugnacious about it. So if he meets someone that has a belief that he thinks is wrong, he just says, "But that's just a lie," or "That's just completely wrong." And of course, immediately the person he's speaking to, I mean, if you see any of these videos of him doing this, the person just goes, "Oh yeah?" And they're not listening after that. And the Buddha doesn't do that here. He says to them, "Well, if that's your goal, then I've got a way to help you achieve it." So he doesn't try to undermine them. And sometimes in the canon you do find the Buddha doing that, but in this case he doesn't. He doesn't try to undermine them. He says to them, "Well, if that's your goal, then I've got some practices that can help you with that." And he just teaches them metta bhavana and the Brahma Viharas. So he doesn't insult them. He doesn't try to undermine them. And he gives them a practice, and we end up calling those practices by a name that those people would have recognized and resonated with. So what I'm suggesting here is that this is the Buddha putting anukampa into practice. He's relating to the values of the people that he's talking to. They're concerned about the afterlife and about what to do in order to ensure a good afterlife. You know, they're like everyone, really. You know, the thought of death is disturbing, is terrifying. So they're looking for some certainty about the afterlife. He doesn't really give them that. He gives them something for now, but he does it in their terms, on their terms. And I'm really struck by the way that the Buddha does that. And you do see lots of examples of him communicating to people in their own language. So, you know, using agricultural metaphors with farmers and imperial metaphors and military metaphors with kings and rulers. So, yeah, that's my talk. It ends a bit abruptly because I couldn't find a better way to do it. But so, I think, you know, this is why anukampa is the standout quality of the Buddha. This is why Ananda was, when he's reflecting on his teacher, this is what he remembers about him. This is what the Buddha brought to all his interactions, his ability to feel what other people were feeling and communicate on that basis, from that point of view. And particularly, you know, I think the text draws out particularly with relation to death and our fears about death and what happens afterwards, because most of us can't imagine there not being an afterwards. So, thank you. Thank you.